in Salem.
Okay. Well, then we'll get...
It's expected imminently.
Then we're going to get rolling with the work session of May 16th. Scott.
Deputy Governor President, councilors. Just a few items for you. Actually, I have a bit of a talking to the board in a minute. I'm here to give you talking points. But I did want to remind you that Metro is bringing Scott Lynn, a nationally known expert, to present his leading the bridge equity approach structural transformation, and that's on the 25th, 26th. We've sent out the invite to that. People still have an opportunity to sign up. Workshop next door is leading with racial equity, which has been one of the sort of conversations that we have engaged repeatedly. And it's a really good opportunity to ground yourself in the work and in the racial equity approach.
Is that a full 2-day workshop, so you have to invest in all of it?
No, it's an either-or opportunity for you. They're here for 2 days, but they're offering two options to you. So there should be a hole on your calendar.
Oh, okay.
CDC should have
Ramona says yes, so, okay. Right.
So
what are
the dates you said? The 25th and 26th. And if not, you can reach out to Juan Carlos. If you can see, reach out, I can have Juan Carlos reach out to you.
There are.
Okay, then a couple of other items. So we have Mr. Moeller come up, and he's going to give you a little bit of a briefing on some sort of conversation.
Thank you, Council President Harrington, Metro Councilors. Thank you, Dan Moeller, Conservation Program Director of Parks and Nature, just here today to give you a very brief briefing on the Title X upgrade process that Metro is about to undergo. You may have spoken with you about this at brief points in the past, but the intent of this process is to review Metro's Title X code, which governs the use of Metro's parks and natural areas. So those are our park rules. To protect the land from wildlife habitat, water quality, and guiding people to nature. It's been several years since we have done any real update to that. And I think as some of you have heard throughout some of the access development projects that we have worked on, that there are interests throughout the community to take a look at that, to have us hear from them, and for us to potentially consider whether the rules currently reflect and really take advantage of the system that we have today, and allow for as much connection to the public as possible, as guided by our system plan. So that's really the project, is to do that. The way that we're intending to do this is to create what we're calling right now a sounding board. Basically, it's an advisory committee of sorts that's comprised of community members who will get together. We'll give them some, little bookends to what the discussion is, but they can really discuss what our current rules are, and really from various perspectives, what rules we should or shouldn't consider as we move forward. Some of the hot buttons, I'm sure, as you're well aware of, are dogs. We currently allow bikes and equestrian on our sites, but there may be various feelings on that. Hunting is another topic that has come up over time. We also wanted to hear from some of the less represented groups that we really haven't engaged in these conversations over time. So we want to engage our community-based organizational partners who we've worked with over the last few years to really get their perspective on, how are our park rules working, what's not working. So this is really, in a nutshell, giving you a very brief overview of what the project is. But that's really what we're attempting to accomplish with this project ultimately, is that sounding board will make recommendations to Metro staff. Metro staff will take those recommendations, filter those through the lens of our system plan, also through the science that we know and the studies that we've developed about recreational impacts on our properties, and ultimately they will take recommendations to Metro Council for your consideration as to whether we should or should not make any adjustments to Title X. The reason I'm in front of you today is we just started yesterday engaging some folks who may or may not be interested in being a part of that sounding board. And in very predictable fashion, there's a lot of passion around that topic. So before maybe more communication happen with you from any of these potential stakeholders who may be a part of that. Martha thought it might be a good idea for me to sit in front of you and give you a brief overview of the project and either take any questions that you have right now or just set up briefings in advance of when we had the plan. The overall timeline for the project is the last thing I just wanted to share. As I mentioned, we're just in the process right now of forming our sounding board or our stakeholder committee. We're going to begin that formal engagement in June, working with the Office of the Metro Attorney and the rest of our staff. We're also going to do a technical review of Title X. There's some housekeeping issues that we need to adjust. You know, there's older references to Multnomah County and just some language adjustments that DT made, so we need to work through that. Now's a good time to do that as well. We'll be engaging council with work sessions and briefings over time. Formal work sessions will probably take place in the fall. We're predicting November right about now, after we've had that engagement with our stakeholders. And then ultimately, if all goes as planned, we'll have this in front of Metro Council for adoption in March of 2018. I know that was quick and probably very high level in general, but I wanted to see if there's anything else I could say that would be helpful at this point or to answer any questions.
Okay, so you got their attention. Because I sure got the in the bill this morning. So you got the Mike Howe stuff and the...
That's great. And Mike, we have corresponded with Mike.
Yes,
We did, and we just had a really nice exchange just recently, so it sounds like he's on board.
Councilor Craddock?
A lot of us have gotten an email from him for a while.
I've been listening a lot from Mike Howe.
Yeah.
We're glad we can keep him awake. Make sure he's charged.
Councilor Craddock?
I assume this group will be people from not only in the region, but outside the region, possibly, from different, you know, and obviously there's a special interest group representing. So what are your plans for the makeup of the group?
Sure. So right now, everybody is a regional. So they have a regional perspective on our system, and that they may come from various interest groups. Right now, we're planning a group of about 9 individuals. We've been working with our facilitator, who's a consultant that we're bringing in to facilitate the group, just so that there can be some separation between, you know, Metro staff and that group. They can have some of an independent and just really robust conversation. We want to have folks who are, you know, pet dog advocates, so somebody who's representing that community on there. We're having somebody we've been talking to from the Oregon Hunters Association, so somebody from that community on there. They've been great to engage with over the last year. They've actually been really helpful in some of the conversations we've had, so we're going to have them. We have, for example, Mr. Howe and the Audubon Society, so conservation advocates. We need to have different perspectives from that community. The educational community, we want to have a representative from that community as well. And then, like I mentioned, our community-based organizations, we're still trying to find, you know, the right balance of that community should be on there. We have CEOs that we work with who are advocates for, you know, getting their community into nature. We have different relationships with other CEOs as well. So we're really working with our DEI team to help us to determine, you know, what's the best composition to have there. But we're looking for a group of about 9 folks.
Go ahead.
Since we have two groups of properties that are outside the mentioned boundary, Chehalem Ridge on one end, and of course all the Oxford properties or Sandy River properties, I was just thinking it would be nice if there's somebody out there that would represent a group that actually sits outside the boundary. You might look at this a little bit differently, but it's just, you know, it's just a suggestion.
I see. I'm sorry. I was when you said regionally, you know, outside of the region, I didn't realize you were mentioning the UGB specifically, but yes, some of these folks who will be on this committee do not live within your
group. Any other questions? So I have a couple things. I'd be interested in seeing what kind of areas you're thinking about. I mean, uses. The one that I hadn't thought about until both North Tualatin as well as Chehalem Ridge came up with stargazing. So I'd like to see the sounding board group look at that. And then I would like for the process that goes through this time frame, to have the Natural Areas Oversight Committee take a look as well. And then once you have the committee set up, I'd like to know who's on it and what perspective they're coming to represent. And I want to make sure we don't have just quote-unquote special interest groups or special user groups, I think is probably the best way to put it. So, you know, who's looking at just things in general. I'm happy to hear that you've got more of the conservation side, you know, sort of general wildlife, but what about having someone that would just remind the group that these are regional assets? We have a system plan. I think that's really important to put this in the context of our own system plan and what properties are categorized for regular public access, what ones might be of the portfolio might be available for special permit public access, and which ones are, I keep calling them no touch ones. Yeah, so that would be just some good information that I'd appreciate hearing about.
Absolutely. I'll definitely follow up on your link. I mentioned I'd be happy to talk to you a little bit more in person when we have one coming. I don't want to take too much away from my colleagues here, but at the same time, thank you for the engagement today. I really appreciate the opportunity just to talk with you briefly, and we will be in close contact as we move forward.
Great.
Just to close that loop, are there any counselors that would like to have a more formal briefing in advance of the work plan? Are you adequately satisfied with just moving forward with the work plan and being informed as part of it? Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Hey,
okay,
you'd like to call on Mr. Melvin?
I'm just looking for some closure on the response letter to the 350 regarding the potential.
I didn't get to read it.
Materials to the build-on facility assets.
This is circulated earlier.
It's circulated letter.
This one is on the
Covanta.
Yes, I did read it.
Yes, so this is a response letter received in, I believe, the Rapid Health Impact Assessments. Under it's currently going on right now, I believe. Maybe over the next 2 weeks before we get some input, so we'd like to send this letter out to.
I missed what you just said about this group. Say it again.
So we're doing, I believe, I don't want to say.
There's a health impact assessment currently being conducted. It is not completed yet, but it's coming.
It's on our council pending.
It won't happen quickly enough, so we would like to get a response letter back to this community in the interim,
yep,
letting them know that work is coming. So we're just really looking for you to kind of give us a thumbs up or not.
I have a question.
Yep.
I think I'm thumbs up with a question. How are we going to get back this information on the health impacts? Are we going to have a work session on that?
Back to our work session, we actually just reviewed that.
Yeah, it's sometime if you look at the council pending, it's sometime in the summer.
Yeah.
That's
and
all
some
I'm
of the
looking.
Folks from that review committee will be participating, or will they have
certainly can extend that invitation?
It might be nice to have some of the folks, because I know there's some folks on there that are very thoughtful, and it might be nice to hear from.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that could be something that we give them a heads up about also, is that there will be a work session where they're public and they can.
Well, we don't usually entertain public comment in our work sessions, so. But you mean to let them know it's publicly available information at our public work session? Yep.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Last thing, Mr. Shaw, he ever ran to give you a update.
So we fully briefed John earlier this morning and then realized he wasn't going to be here. So he can't provide that information. Anyway. Good week so far this week. Our land use bill 2095 had a hearing in the Senate Business and Transportation Committee. Both a hearing and a work session passed out on a 4-1 vote. The one vote against was actually not about the bill, but about anger at a particular city in our region and a different issue. And that was actually openly expressed. Let's say everybody gets my they change his vote before the Senate floor. So,
does the appropriate district counselor know?
No, not yet.
Okay.
I'll tell him when he arrives.
Okay.
You can tell the W.
Yes, it is very south. Yes, it's near an airport. Yeah. It's not in our region. Yes, it was a very good hearing. Tom and Chair Bernard and Dan Doyle all testified on the panel. Did a great job filling sort of the big level questions, and then there were a series of the rest of us finishing again with Home Builders and Thousand Friends and the panel together testifying in support of the bill. So. Forward progress that we've had now to the Senate floor with that bill, hopefully as soon as next Monday, and can get through the process before things get really crazy in June. Recreational immunity, we've been keeping you posted on that legislation. There was a hearing this last week, very positive, trying to figure out, once again, how to navigate the bill out of the House Policy Committee. As you may recall, we struggled a bit to get the bill out of the Senate Policy Committee. Once it was out, I had a very, very strong vote on the Senate floor. There were some similar challenges with wresting the bill out of committee because of a little bit of concern coming from trial lawyers and others. That is kind of floating in the background. But we think that it's an amazing team. The list of support has like an 8 by 17 sheets. The list is so long of folks that have been on the list of years for us recreation. So hopefully we'll see that bill move out of committee soon and on through the process. Clean diesel, Senate Bill 1008 is the other measure I thought I'd report out on. As you may recall, that bill got stripped down to very few provisions of the initial provisions that were in the bill. Senator Denbrough has a -3 amendment, which adds back in a few of the elements of the initial bill, but it's pretty darn watered down for what the proposal is, and that may even struggle to gain support in the committee and move on. So we'll keep you posted on that, that things don't look great for a lot of progress on clean diesel this session. There's a very strong connection to the transportation package and folks saying, comparing it to the clean fuels program of the last cycle, not wanting to see this move forward if they're going to vote to raise gas taxes and put costs on that part of the system. So we will continue to advocate for the general policy. The provision we did like that talked about shifting CMAQ funds out of where they are now to work on things that was taken out of the bill a long time ago is no longer a part of the discussion. So we're just in the mode of supporting provisions either in the bill or in the -3 amendments and trying to move that forward. But honestly, things don't look great for that bill this session. The other very busy realm is transportation. The Joint Transportation Committee held its second of what will now be at least 3 hearings going over the elements of the package that were outlined to the whole committee by work groups. And in the round, in public, sort of having the whole committee say, we like this, we don't like this, we're comfortable with this, we're not. They've never built a bill like this before, and it's intended to direct their legislative council with each section of the proposals to go draft the bill in a way that supports where the committee lands on each different piece. So last night, for example, they were talking about an excise fee on new vehicles, and it was proposed at 1% plus 2.5% increases, and folks said that seems a little high, so it went back to 1% for the duration. So they're moving fast and furious. Hopefully this produces a bill in the next couple weeks. All this.
Were they thinking, was that different than the bill you had mentioned you were talking about on companies that own car sales?
This would be a privilege tax that would be assessed of the car dealership. So the theory is you're not connecting it to car ownership, and therefore it is free of the constitutional provision about spending money in the right way. Yes.
They're still trying to maintain that.
They are still trying to maintain that. They plan to use the money from the excise tax on new vehicles to partially fund their share of the bottleneck projects. So that's a big highway investment. And take other portions and use it to fund what used to fund the Connect Oregon program, so shifting that away from lottery funds. And then they're looking at a few other multimodal projects, rail projects that would move freight off of trucks and onto rail, theory. So they're trying to connect it to congestion relief overall, but they fully acknowledge there's a legal test to come. And they're putting provisions in to say if it gets sued with no return, then something else happens. There's a lot of interesting maneuvering.
It's Ben Elsa's, hopefully.
And they're thinking about this. The other big shift that's occurring, we've talked a bit about last week, is on the surcharge, the regional surcharge, which would form the basis of our ability to match the state's investment in the bottlenecks. They're shifting from the state imposing it to the providing local authority. We collectively have raised a whole host of concerns about that shift. We talked about this a bit last week. In particular, that you can't, if the state imposes it, there's no local referral. The whole package may get referred by folks that don't like it. If you provide local authority, even if you say you have to refer it out to a vote, you can't remove the constitutional requirement that the people would refer it. We're already hearing gas dealers and others threaten to refer any local surcharge, which is unfortunate. So we're in discussions with leaders of the transportation committee to say, we said we meant we would like to go Dutch, but that means we're, I mean, I said this when I testified, we're picking the restaurant together. So you can't just shift on us and say we're starting
to dinner.
A happy hour price. We have to keep working together in a way that makes this whole thing work. So we're in very close contact with the key leaders there to keep talking about what the threats of referral are, what the benefits of being at the state level versus the local level. The primary driver on that is truckers being very wary of additional weight mile taxes and the understanding of how that regional surcharge would affect weight mile taxes. So we're also fiercely working to figure out what we think the impact on the weight mile would be if you had a mixture of bottleneck investments and local arterial and other investments. We think it's much lower than the truckers fear. This is also a brand new concept, and they plan to do it in the metro area and replicate it in other MPOs. So if you're on the side of trying to limit those cost increases over time, you might see this as something that's going to multiply with all kinds of new higher taxes that, yes, help fund bottleneck improvements and congestion relief, but also could accrue to the cost that truckers face. So, we've had a lot of discussions about how, at our local end, we would govern the surcharge if it were so lucky as to get a bill out that creates the surcharge. I think we've made a lot of progress at the staff level and with our councilors who were involved in some of these ad hoc morning meetings to reach a compromise that we talked about a little bit last week, where there would be a lot of project development at the coordinating committees, a subcommittee of JPAC with one representative from each of the members of JPAC, full JPAC review, and then Metro Council review, but at a higher level, sort of, is this consistent with our land use and transportation plans, and others of other criteria that would all be in the statute for how projects get developed and approved through the process. So that's still percolating, but we think we've gotten to a place where there seems to be general agreement amongst those that were very involved in the conversations.
Councillor Stacey, you were first.
Thank you, Deputy Council President Harrington. I'm practicing saying that. It's a long title.
Harrington will do.
Not very polite, though. Thanks for that summary, Andy. I'm, of course, concerned about I'm concerned about the concern that the gasoline dealers currently have about the impacts of maybe a 9-cent gas surcharge or something in that range. I recall that about 10 days ago, I filled up for $2.30 in northeast Portland on our way out of town. And yesterday, I passed my local gas station a few blocks south of here, and it was $2.89 a gallon. What terrible havoc will be wrought on that price spread by the imposition of 9-cent increase?
I was in the League of Cities as a staffer working on transportation. I did a survey up and down I-5 of gas prices compared to where local gas taxes exist. There is no connection.
I couldn't tell what it would be.
Zero connection.
Sorry, got it.
Strange market forces drive what is on the pump at a particular gas station. It seems to have no connection to state, federal, local gas taxes. So, interestingly, the argument that was made against the gas tax that the city of Portland proposed was passed by the gasoline dealers, which opposed, they opposed that, that gas tax proposal. Their argument was that truckers wouldn't pay their fair share. So, I mean, you can see the same problem being faced by this region if a referral came about by a locally enacted surcharge, even though what we were trying to do was get the state to impose it so their truckers would pay their fair share. So,
yeah.
We're working very hard to get, at the moment, get Senator Hokus back to the initial proposal, which was just oppose it at the state level. They had talked about maybe making JPACs raise their hand and say, we support this before it became enacted as a trigger. Trying to tell them very clearly, we're not, it's not a matter of getting out of sharing the risk of enacting this. It's more the structural factors to make this thing work. So far, we're having productive conversations. We've got some allies from the Portland region who are very concerned about potential referral and threat referral, but this is one of a dozen different pieces that are very tricky to balance and get the committee to move forward. So,
Councilor Craddock?
Well, I have some questions about the specific language that's in the surcharge funding decision-making process. And I wonder if maybe, I assume Craig is going to respond, is going to report back on your meeting Friday. Should we wait and have that discussion at the end of this meeting? Because it's more, some of the details, or we can have it now. I have copies of this document here. It's up to you guys.
Can you come back?
Yes.
Are you able to stay there and be here?
Okay. Let's do it at the end. Do you have anything else?
That's it.
I have a question on with regard to Thursday's meeting agenda.
Okay.
I thought it would be an appropriate time to bring this up. On under ordinances, ordinance item, agenda item 5.1, 17-1401 for the purpose of adopting a landfill capacity policy and amending Metro Code Chapters 5.00 and 5.05. Just so you know what the subject is. I received a voicemail message from Yamhill County Commissioner Popanovich with regard to this ordinance. And he communicated to me in that voicemail message that he wanted me to know that the Yamhill County Commission, the full commission, continues to be supportive of receiving metro area waste from the region, particularly as they are interested in seeing green technology being implemented at that landfill, which we heard about from our prior site visits. And he asked me to give him a call back. So I wanted to make sure I reported that, shared that, because I don't know if he's been calling any other members of the council at all. I don't know if anyone has reached out, so beyond our publication of this, if anyone has reached out to the Yamhill County Administration or their Board of Commissioners to know this is before us, or if we've heard anything about if they would be coming and testifying on Thursday. I thought now would be the right place for me to raise this.
There have been communications with the Yamhill County Commission previously. I don't know how recently, so I can certainly find that out from staff and report that back.
Okay. Well, if all of this has been taken care of, I didn't want to gunk up the works and call him, you know, now that I'm back from vacation and trying to catch up to everybody else. So,
I was only going to note, Mr. President, that there were two or three letters in this Monday's compilation of emails sent to our general mailbox on this topic, and I trust staff will reach out. There's all of that included within my...
Great.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you very much. That's just what I wanted to contribute.
Great.
So, shall we move on to the worksheet, the work session topics? The Southwest Corridor Equitable Development Strategy.
And if I could, Deputy Council President Harrington, as staff is coming up and being settled, just make a couple of opening remarks. Councilor Craddock and I had the honor of co-chairing the steering committee on the then Powell Division and now Division Transit Project. And we both learned that for several members of our steering committee, as well as many members of the public and some local businesses, concern about the impact of potential greater accessibility for the route and alignment of the division transit investment was at least as strong as people's desire to see better transit service. Concern about the impact on housing costs and on rents for small businesses. Concerns fundamentally about displacement of existing residents and businesses. That became a significant component of the work of the steering committee and the recommendations, particularly of the City of Portland's action plan to carry out the goals related to the transit investment. So I'm very pleased that that we're here today to hear about the initial steps under a grant received from the Federal Transit Administration to do a very comprehensive look at economic opportunity, housing affordability and housing opportunity, and the threat of displacement in the work we do going forward with Councillor Dirksen's leadership of the steering committee in the Southwest Corridor to make sure that we anticipate these concerns in a way that we can certainly catch up in order to address in the division project. This is a growing area of concern across the country. Equitable TOD, it's called in some circles, but the idea that there is an affirmative responsibility to anticipate the negatives as well as the positives that can be planned to respond to rather than just dealt with after the fact. So I'm glad that some of our capable staff, Ryan Harper, are here to describe the way forward.
Thank you, Councilor Stacey. So we've had a chance to brief a number of you, but you haven't had a chance to hear together. So we are here today to talk about the Southwest Equitable Development Strategy. We call it SWEDS for short. Not really, not sure what that acronym really means.
Any
So, but we're really excited to start this work, and for all the reasons that Councillor Stacey described. And I'd like to just start with a little bit of context and remind you that our approach to the Planning and Development Department under Alyssa's guidance has really been to ensure that we always start out by focusing on why we're doing the work that we're doing. We're not, we aren't trying to do the most interesting technical study that has all of the best data, the reason that we're doing this work is really to be sure that people and a variety of people in the region have opportunities to live and work and play and learn in the communities that we all live in and serve. So we focus really on three areas for everything that we do in the Planning and Development Department right now. We focus on partnerships, planning, and implementation. And if we don't have good partnerships set up in place before we do the planning work, that we really do want to be innovative and creative and have a sound foundation for the types of policy decisions that we ask you to make, we'll never see implementation on the ground in the communities that we all care about. So that's really what we're doing here. That's the context and the framework that we're working under. And I also just want to remind you of our approach in the investment area section. That's my team in the Planning and Development Department. And we all know that when we make a large investment in transportation, like a light rail transit project, that catalyzes private development. But we want to be sure that it's catalyzing the right kind of private development that will serve a broad spectrum of people and their needs. And so, as Councillor Stacey said, we want to learn from the experience in Powell Division and be able to take those lessons and apply them even further. And we can't ignore the importance of equitable development in our region. It's at the forefront of concern. Every time you pick up the paper, there's more about affordable housing. And Chris was just reading about how what we don't want to become is San Francisco, where only 13% of the people who live there, if I got that number right, are able to afford to live.
Or the median house price.
Yes. So
$267,000 a year.
That's a scary future that we don't want, and that's one reason that we applied for this grant, and we're really excited that we have the money to begin to leverage our resources in a way that maximizes benefit for all types of people. So, going back in time, Metro and our partners all endorsed a shared investment strategy for the Southwest Corridor plan, and that included investments in transit, high-capacity transit, and local transit service. It included improvements in roadway, bikes, bicycle, and pedestrian facilities. It also included parks and habitat investments that were all based on a land use vision that our communities created themselves, and with funding from you also through the community planning and development grants, now have a much more pleasing or easy to roll off the tongue name. But this work that we're talking about now takes that shared investment strategy and builds on it. So that's really the foundation of the work. And then what we want to be sure that we can do, you know, right now we have 3 investment areas in the region. You know, I can't imagine with my staff we'd ever be able to do more than 3, but we won't always be focused in these 3 places. But we want to be able to apply what we do through this project, not just in the Southwest Corridor, but in other places throughout the region. And so that, you know, being able to scale our work and apply it in other places in the future is important. This is a chart that you have simplified. You have this in your packet as well, but I want to just cover a little bit about what's going on in Southwest Corridor right now, because there are a lot of different activities. And today, the orange line across the top is the Southwest Corridor Equitable Development Strategy. That's what Brian is going to talk to you about in a moment. But you all know we also have the light rail draft environmental impact statement that Chris and his team are working on. We're on schedule right now to complete that draft EIS by the end of 2017. That will lead to, we hope, our steering committee recommending a locally preferred alternative for that light rail project in early 2018. We also have the purple bar across there, are the equitable housing grants that you as the Metro Council gave to Portland and Tigard and Washington County. Portland and Tigard are directly focused into Southwest Corridor, and Washington County parts of that may also be Southwest Corridor related, so that's another piece of the puzzle to align, and that's part of what Brian and those who are working with him have been doing, is trying to align all these pieces so that we spend our money, we leverage our money, we don't duplicate our efforts. We also, the purple line across there is the Economic Value Atlas that Jeff Rager, who's right there, remember him, is leading. There's a component of the Economic Value Atlas that will have a pilot project in the Southwest Corridor. So that will be happening over the next 2 years. And additionally, TriMet led an application to the University of Oregon Sustainable Cities Year program to have a whole slew of professors and students focusing in on the Southwest Corridor and a variety of different projects in the upcoming academic year. So you'll be hearing about that over the next year. Portland State has a naturally occurring affordable housing study that is happening at the moment that's focused also on Southwest Corridor. So that's an opportunity to identify potential places that we might want to preserve the affordable housing that's already there. So there's a lot going on, and that is one reason why it has taken us, while we were awarded this grant last fall, it's taken us a while to figure out how we can best target this money with all of the other things that are going on. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Brian.
Excellent. Councilor, good to see you. I'm excited to be here today to talk about this work. As Melissa stated last, she stated we got the grant last fall, but last summer we were notified, probably a year ago this month, I believe it was May of last year, we were notified that FTA had an opportunity for jurisdictions to apply for a Todd development grant through their program. We had a 6-week window to apply for that grant, so we were scrambling a little bit to figure out what that application was going to look like. A team of individuals, including Chris Ford and Jeff Baker, and Emily, were part of the group that helped kind of put that together. And, you know, Tyler was hired to save us with the final approval application. So it was really a team effort. Our initial I should mention that the grant application was for New Starts projects only. We had an initial thought that maybe this would be a great grant opportunity for the Division Transit project, but it was not eligible for this, these funds. Our initial application really focused on addressing how large-scale transit investments impact displacement and quality of life. So that was the theme that kind of surrounded that application. We're trying to have a different conversation with Councilor Stacey and you too about how about these types of investments. We're focusing both on benefits and impacts. We need to get out in front, like you said, about what happens when we make these kind of large step public investments. We were notified again, and we received the award in October of last year. And this was just before you know we're getting the award yet, beginning to award the equitable housing grants to many jurisdictions. So we knew that before we developed a work program around this grant, we needed to make sure that we were complimented to any efforts that were going on in those grants. Specifically, we do not want to duplicate any efforts and not spend the money wisely. And it's a good thing. I think it's really great that we did work. We've been working directly with Tigard and Portland and Washington County on their work plan, which will allow us to integrate that in a way that's complementary to the project here, and I'll go over that in a little while. And the IGAs for those have just kicked off, so that work is underway now. The work components of our grant can be broken out into five pieces here, and I'm going to go through these. Partnerships and used to like the three pieces that Malou first referenced for the investment areas group. Partnerships are really critical. So the first part is partnerships and building our data, building the data kind of like to public face. The second part is our analysis, where we take a deep look at what does that data mean for the corridor, and then looking at our strategy development implementation and how we can use that to build capacity within the corridor as well. Go that a little bit here in a minute. And then of course the regional application, which Malou referenced earlier as well. So in terms of our partnership and community profiles, I want to go back and talk a little bit about, you remember this work that was done last year, I believe, on our housing strategy. That's really great work. Emily did a fantastic job on it. Many people did a fantastic job on it, but Emily delivered. And this focused a little bit on households and resident housing needs based on wages and housing rents and costs. I think what we'd like to do as we move on to this, you can see this slide is about ownership. I think we understand it's a critical question. Obviously, right now, it's a really important question in our region in terms of housing costs, and you being before. But more importantly, we feel like there's more here than just housing that's important, and that's access to jobs and where those jobs exist, people's ability to access educational opportunities and better their perspective in life. We want to build on these existing profiles by adding more data on top that talks a little bit more about where people work, where the jobs exist, what jobs pay living wages, what are the educational opportunities, what kind of jobs and education do people need to move into different income brackets or to have access to income that allows them to live a little differently. And so we're going to build something that's akin to this, what is sometimes referenced as a self-sufficiency model. So we're looking at all the things that go into how people live. So this is just an example of work done. I believe this is done by Work Systems. And it's something we're thinking, this is our thoughts around this, around the data. We'd be looking at more than just housing costs, and more than just transportation costs, but some of all the other costs that line up for people to live their life. And what's left over when they're done paying for all the things that they have to pay for to live, and what kind of quality of life does that give them? And then marrying that with, What are all the opportunities in South Dakota that people have access to? Whether that be parks or open space or other items that you can't necessarily quantify in the number that people spend money on, but that are equally important to their quality of life. Moving from that data set, that robust data set, we would do more analysis of the quarter. So this is just, again, an example of work that's been done in the region. This was work looking at displacement risks that was done in the city of Gresham, but luckily, the work was done region-wide on some scale to look at other risks associated with displacement region-wide. This particular map up here just shows percent of income spent on housing from a family earning a specific wage. So this is just an example of something you might also look at. What does it cost beyond just housing as well? What does it cost for a family to live affordably? And you can see in this is from 2013, this is right in that midpoint here, Southwest Corridor. You can see the outline there, Southwest Corridor, right in the midpoint. It's not quite branching into unaffordable yet in this, but it's not in that fully affordable category. And as we move on to this next slide, which really shows you change in affordability over a 10-year time frame, you can start to see that there's some red dots popping up in Southwest Corridor. So what this is telling us is there's risk in Southwest Corridor already happening beyond whether we make this investment or not. If we make this large-scale investment, we're we're likely going to contribute to rising land value in some cases. We're going to contribute to some of that, and that's the risk we need to get out ahead of. And so this work, hopefully this analysis we'll do, will be similar to this, will be identifying where are the biggest risks for displacement. Where are the biggest risks for people that exist there now? There's kind of this thought that the corridor is fairly wealthy, and why do they need this investment? This corridor is doing well. But the truth is, this corridor has plenty of pockets of disadvantaged populations or people that are at risk. And it's not obvious to a lot of people, but we see it. And those of us who work in Southwest Corridor for the last 3 or 4 years know it very well because we've engaged with the people who live in this corridor. So it's there. It's one of the reasons we have to start talking about it and looking at it in more detail. The third step would be strategy development and implementation. I'll go into this a little bit more when we talk about the structure of the how we're going to run the grant, but the idea here is that we take all this analysis and decide what are the key components we need to focus on for both local actions and maybe even potentially the regional action that might need to be taken, and using the grant itself and the structure of the grant to find pilot projects in each one of those very specific categories to address some of these threats and resources flexibility. Concerns, and along the way, building community capacity. So, again, I'll speak to that just a little bit. We talk about the grant itself, how it's structured. And of course, we'd like to end with regional application. Like we said, part of our grant application FTA was this isn't a one off for Southwest Corridor alone. We'd like to be sure that this is something that works here, and we can make it work, and we can scale this up to the region, and we can look at any investment area in the region, any place in the region where we're going to make some sort of large-scale investment, and we can utilize this tool to see what kind of impacts we should try to get out ahead of, or what we might be facing with that investment. So our outcomes for this grant generally are, of course, the Southwest Corridor Equitable Development Strategy for the corridor itself. We want this to be community, we want this implementation to be community-driven. We would like to, based on policy direction from the oversight committee that I'll go over in a second, and the advisory groups will be involved in this, we'd like them to set the direction, what types of investments and pilot programs we need to implement in this corridor. These are the experts we're going to be relying on this grant to tell us what's the best course of action, what are the things you should be spending this money on to fix. And then, of course, what we call a regional quality of life standard, or what we call a self-sufficiency standard, we want to set some kind of bar from what we're going to utilize and can work with over the coming years. And what should we be looking for in our region to identify what's important for how people live their lives in the region? So very briefly, here's just an overview of how the grant is structured. So you can see in the center we have a project oversight committee that would report directly to staff. This would be comprised of leadership in many different arenas. We have maybe the meanness group, probably Alyssa would be part of the meanness group. We do not have a full list of people decided upon at all. We have names we're considering. Part of your day is to talk to you about other people you should be considering. I thought you may have on that. This project oversight committee will be supported by three separate advisory groups. And these groups are in green, purple, and orange on that chart. These advisory groups will be focused on very specific parts of the work plan. The green, you'll see, is for business and workforce advisory group. Sounds like the old, I think. The purple is equity housing advisory group, and the orange is finance and investment advisory group. I should point out that the equity and housing subgroup is actually already informed. That is actually made up of City of Portland and City of Tigard's equitable housing grant partners that are helping them to implement their grants, and that's one way we've been able to integrate their grants with this grant. We're not duplicating efforts, not convening a second group. We're going to utilize their experience and expertise already ongoing in the board through your grants that you've given them to influence this grant or to help us with this grant. Our workforce group and our finance group will be led by Jeff Raker and Patrick Laughlin from our Todd and investment areas group accordingly. We will also have an interagency team that's made up of high-level staff, so community development director, Kenyash from Tiger, TriNet, or others at that level will be there to help direct some of the work, to bounce ideas off of, to help the oversight committee make some decisions. And of course, there will be ongoing discussions with both Southwest Corridor leadership and steering committee and with the Metro Council as we check in regularly about what the work is, what we're seeing in the work, what the data is showing, and get your thoughts and input and feedback on which direction we're going. This is just a little more description of these groups. I should mention that we have engaged the DEI program to align their work to provide
participation slots for two specific groups so far, the Momentum Alliance and the Coalition of Communities of Color Bridges Program currently. We are open to other opportunities and avenues, of course, but we want to make this open to as many people as possible and have as much inclusion as possible in these groups as we're talking about the work moving forward. So, of course, we do want to make sure that we've adequately explained, at least at the level we can now, the work program. The RFP, we're working on an RFP potentially to get started, but we want to make sure that we hit everything we should before we go any further down that road. And, of course, is there anything missing that you can see from this work program? Particularly, I think we're really interested in specific partners you'd recommend to engage in the grant. Of course, we have a list of many names, and these people are being asked to work and sit on many other committees and many other efforts related to equitable housing and related to many other issues around the region. So we want to be cognizant of that, but we want the best people possible sitting and thinking about these issues and problems.
And before we open the floor to questions, I would like to kind of summarize about the program. This work is really critical, and the solutions to our challenges in the corridor are not rooted solely in housing. Although that is a critical component, access to jobs and education also impacts people's lives. We need to shape our major public investments to provide ladders of opportunity to all types of people in our region. The Southwest Corridor is job-rich now, and that's expected to grow over time. The corridor is also home to a number of educational opportunities, including PSU, OHSU, Fort Lee Community College, and George Fox University. And all of this opportunity will become more accessible, both with the light rail line and the other transportation improvements that are planned as well. Now, this, as Brian said, this corridor may appear wealthy and not deserving of major public investment. But in this case, wealthy is just a code word for expensive. And that translates to lack of opportunity for folks of limited means, both for housing and access to all those jobs that we say are in the corridor. And we also know that this corridor already has populations at risk of displacement, such as in Southwest Portland, the Somali community, and also a growing Latino population throughout this corridor. The SWED's effort also, we believe, will help make the light rail project more competitive for national and state funding by better describing all the facets of the complex community and proposing an equitable development strategy in conjunction with the light rail construction.
Councillor Chase.
Well, I'll jump in. Really appreciate this, package and having this strategy as part of it. I think this is one of the most important things for us to be focused on as we do this work. I know that you're looking for folks and ideas around the community. I will think about that. I looked at the list for the Equitable Housing Committee, and that was a really solid group of folks that you have in place there. So appreciate that. One of my reflections about this is, the importance of that equity work as we're doing transportation. I want both. I want a great transportation system, and I want people to be able, everybody to have access to that transportation system. And as we're doing this work, and I think you articulated the lot of housing needs. I'm going to talk about housing in particular because I think that's one of the biggest costs. When you add transportation and housing, you're talking about you can have over 45% for people. So that's a significant. That's a tool that we know we can put in place to address these issues. I'm open to, workforce strategies and business strategies. To me, I need to understand and see whether there are some viable strategies there. I know that there are strategies with housing tied to transportation to address poverty. Minnesota has tied, I think, some of the bonds to housing for their transit developments. I'd love to learn more about that. Los Angeles in March passed a measure that
ERP notice. One was in November around transit and more incentives for development in transit areas. The closer you are to transit, the further away you are from transit. You know, I guess as this work moves forward, I'm very interested, and I liked how you said that the committee's going to come up with strategies, not you know, analysis necessarily. You know, I think there'll be some analysis, and you know, I understand. But we've also done a lot of analysis. You really articulated it very well, and there's a ton more than what you even articulated. And I think for us, now is the time to be looking at what are the strategies that we can truly make meaningful change around. And so there's a difference to me. My strategies are pretty boring, you know, which is, but I'm actually pretty convinced that we need some of those boring strategies, and that is you can't create the most affordable housing that's needed without resources. You have to have resources to make those kinds of development work. And so you can kind of package and leverage and take other resources that would otherwise be available maybe to other parts of the region and better prioritize and use them there, but you're not necessarily getting a net gain there. You're shifting your priority. So my point is that I am concerned that we aren't going to look at strategies where new resources are part of the equation. And so is that where we're keeping some of the land that gets staged during construction of the projects? Is it that we're taking 20% of a bond and dedicating those funds to the banking of affordable land in near the transit areas? Is it a companion strategy where we focus on passing a construction excise tax that funds and gives us the ability to fund housing strategies? To me, those are the things that we really need to be serious about looking at. I, as I've told before, met somebody who's made a living just buying land along these corridors and not renovating, not painting, not landscaping, not upgrading the properties, just sitting on them. And so every time we make a decision, you know, as the time goes by, those values are going up, and you probably could see it if you even looked at it for the last 3 or 4 years. It's going to continue to do that, I think. So just the urgency to me of us really evaluating where and how we can get resources on the table to address this, to me that needs to be a real part of this work if we're going to be successful. I could keep going, but I'm going to stop here.
Councillor Collette.
Well, I'll pick it up from there. Because I think we're sort of on the same track. My initial question is kind of, what is this RFP about? And is it a consultant that's going to facilitate the committee to do some data collection and thinking about it, or is it going to be running the grant to do the kind of either land making, or I'm concerned that it not just be a study and that we actually get some, you mentioned pilot projects, get some pilot projects. This is a pretty substantial grant, and I know we could easily spend it all on studies and community engagement, but I would really love that if one of the things that comes out of it are some pilot projects,
or
whatever.
Yeah, I could actually probably should speak to that. I didn't go into any detail about that, but the whole idea behind this application, when we applied for it, was very specifically, we don't need to do a ton more data building.
Yeah.
We don't need to do a ton more data analysis. We held back a considerable amount of dollars in the budget of this grant for the pilot project part, probably more than most grants, I would assume most grants have done in this kind of instance. The idea is we have a world-class data organization in the building, and we're going to utilize them to do our data collection, and they're here right now, and they are fantastic, and I don't see any need to hire a consultant to do that work. We will need a consultant to do some data analysis. I just think that's going to be common. We're going to need them to help us work with the strategy side of things, I think, a little bit as well. That's what the RFP is about. It's not about the pilot program and the community-driven implementation. That's
really those advisory groups, those subcommittees of sub-advisory groups to help determine what that is. They may have a list to choose from. There may be any number of things that come out of that work that we decide. And it would be to them to decide which ones are the most impactful and push forward the ideas that are most impactful. So a real hope is that a sizable chunk of this gets spent on the implementation side.
So if I might follow up, I think we're at a stage of our information now that probably one of the best things we could do would be to help local organizations to acquire the ability to actually start buying land. Like Pano and the Virtue Store, building that capacity in the community to be owning, there's somebody making a fortune off of buying land along light rail lines. Why can't it be people in the community or community of color organizations? Can we start giving them that skill set? That to me is, we can think all we want about affordable housing and protecting resources in the light rail corridor. The only thing that's really going to do is money, investing in ownership, and job creation, I think you mentioned, is a really critical part of that. So if there's some way to make sure that that's a part of what we're doing here, I think that would make the most sense from my perspective.
I think what we're hoping to do is be able to build some of that capacity. There isn't an Apollo himself for
it. Yeah.
What we can't do with this grant is actually buy land. It is planning money, and we're trying to use it as creatively as possible by creating capacity like that. But and to identify opportunities for others to purchase land who can use the money to do that. There are a number of groups that build affordable housing who are involved in the Portland and Tiger grants and will be involved with this. The City of Portland has their new money that they're looking to be able to purchase land, and we have our own programs that can do that as well. So we're looking to set the stage and build a community capacity to allow some of that to happen.
And some of our initial conversations, we've had with, say, my own Royal Trust, we think that they're the same, we're on the same page, I think, of what you just said. And I think that we can't make any promises of what's going to come out of this work, but I think we can see as staff that there's definitely a direction we're going. And we're hearing a lot of those same comments from people like Meyer, where they can make a difference and have influence over that outcome. And so we're hopeful that as they're part of that conversation, ideas that can be generated out of this can be, they can help implement that.
Councilor Craddock?
I want to follow up on Councilor Stacey's comments. It's really rewarding to see the progress we make in learning from one experience to the other. And of course, my first experience was with the East Central Connection Plan and how that now led to the division, the RT, and what we learned from that, and now applying it to the software board. So I really appreciate that you're listening and reading and applying.
I was there with the whole way, Councilor. I was on all those projects.
So that we're applying with that learning. I'm just really pleased with the work that what your plans are here. But I just to follow up on some of the interest effort of how can we take it one step further and actually put something on the ground. I hope as you form these committees that you're including legislators from the state, and because they're going to probably have to help us with some of this, and get them engaged, get a group of them that are, that are interested and understand this and learn from this themselves, that then can apply that to the work they do with the state legislature, and maybe get legislators that aren't necessarily from the southwest part of the region. There's others. I'm thinking that people from the represents from the east part of the region too. So that might help us with taking it that next step and land banking with money to be able to really make things happen. And I assume we're going to come out of this, I know Councilor Chase has his way, we'll at some point really do more about how we're building affordable housing. At some point we need to look at that more thoroughly. And so maybe we'll learn from this, maybe that'll give us some insight to what that might be in the future if we're really going to try to do more. Todd extra or something, and the Todd program, what it is. I don't know. Anyway, so no, this will give us some insight to that.
So I'm going to jump in now. My input really focuses on information that you have in slides 15 and 17, 15 being the outcomes one and 17 being the partner consortium, but they also touch on the overall timeline too. In these two slides, you have talked about, you list the outcomes on slide 17, but in some ways it's pretty hard to see how these different groups of the consortium play a role in the delivery or formation of some of these outcomes. So that's, they're looking too disjoint to me. In that way, and I had read the verbiage copy in the packet as well. So something's missing for me because I see them as standalone but not linked enough. And I think it's worthy of some reinforcement in the presentation because it's important work. And I want to make sure that as there are other presentations on this, that folks can see that linkage. I'm on that outcome slide. I'm interested in seeing this regional quality of life standard because that's a new thing. And a couple of things. I couldn't figure out where that's going to come up in the timeline at all. So I'd like to hear an answer to that question. And I don't know if you have an answer off the top of your head.
So basically, you look at the...
What slide number was that?
This, the flow chart.
Yeah.
It's actually...
There it is. It's in the packet, I know. Yeah. But this is where I'm taking notes, so... So when's it come in, Brian? Help me out.
Pretty early. It comes in usually between the partners for building these community profiles. Really, when I speak of the community profiles, I'm talking about this quality of life index. So my hope would be like near the end of the partnerships and profiles or finalizing that somewhere in the beginning part of that stationary sub-area analysis would be doing. So right after this first, arrow right here.
Okay. Okay, so sometime in 17?
Yeah, 18? Sometime later, this is probably the end of the summer, early fall would be my guess.
This year?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, well, related to that, I think that is something that I don't know what your plans are to bring any of this to MPAC, but I think that's a particular one that you'd want to help us and our MPAC partners learn more about. Because it has the word regional, and recalling our multi-year effort to get to the definition and adoption of the six the regional desired outcomes, and there's only six of them. It took quite an effort, and I think this is going to be really informative, and I want everyone to be able to identify with that. So I'm encouraged by that. Then on back to that slide 17. So I, with the whole Southwest Corridor project, one of the really interesting opportunities out of that, eventually out of it, will be the redevelopment of the Tiger Triangle as well as value add and connection with Tiger Downtown. You've heard me say this before. Sorry, broken record. So what I'm struggling a little bit with is on the consortium groups, there's group 3 and group 4. So let me step back for a second. I was surprised a few years ago with a proposed plan before the city of Beaverton in my district, and a particular office building, a few office buildings are owned by a particular party, and that property owner chose to tell their leaseholdies that this potential work in building a road connection in a center would jeopardize their being able to retain low rent levels. And so all these very small business proprietors showed up at a planning commission meeting and then at a city council meeting, just, you know, the sky is falling kind of thing. And I'm like, wait a second, this is a great opportunity for redevelopment in that area. And without this light rail line, there are real challenges to redeveloping that area to its potential. And so I'm wondering about the engagement of the property owners in the write-up in the packet. The Finance and Investment Advisory Group didn't really speak to me about engaging with property owners in that area. And I'm hoping it will. It just sounded a little too generic. And then also for making sure that if there is a business, like it's not as large of a chamber, but if there's a business coalition in that area that's separate from the building owners and the property owners, that somehow they're engaged as opposed to this is something that's being done to us. Because this is wonderful planning.
Yeah, you actually hit, that's actually hitting on a topic we talked about, that we don't know if that'll be an outcome of what we're looking at. Say, like, Barbara, for instance, has no real centralized
disparate
business
association. Yeah.
And Triangle doesn't have a centralized business association. Downtown Tiger does. Yeah. And so what may come out of this is we need to focus more on that side of things.
That capacity
that's
building.
That's really critical and important to making sure, because, again, one of the drawbacks could be you could see increased rents in these, you know, these issues, and so how do you protect some of those smaller businesses they don't get
okay.
So, yeah, that's actually something we're talking about.
Okay.
It may be an outcome that we see out of this.
Okay. And then I think the last one I have is... I heard that through this grant we were holding a lot of money for pilot projects. I'm a little bit confused. Back to slide 15 on outcomes and community-driven implementation based on policy direction from SWEDS, advisory groups will deliver pilot project proposals. So you're not actually holding money back to have pilot projects implemented, but rather have plans for pilot projects for subsequent implementation. Because just saying you're holding money for pilot projects means it's for implementation of pilot projects.
I think it depends. We are holding aside money that we are unsure exactly the best way to spend some of it, because we want these groups to define what that is for pilot projects if they are... it depends, the implementation of it with this money depends on what it is, because there are limits on how much you spend FDA dollars.
So if they say buy properties, we can't do that, but
right.
There's a whole host of other things we could do.
So it's going to foster pilot projects. What exactly is still TBD? So I think the word deliver there is a little too loaded. That's all. Because I think I'm following your intention now. You know, there's flexibility, there's TBD, right? To be defined, all of that. That's good. That's what we want from this. Okay. Thank you for me. And then Councillor Chase, you had some more.
Well, just to, actually around, just to support some of the comments I heard, and then specifically to the pilot project for public parks, that was helpful clarification. Because I think that a helpful strategy for the equity work group to focus on would be to evaluate what other strategies are already out there and have been piloted. You know, again, it's a little more boring in some ways, but it's like our COG program is fantastically, you know, moving forward on certain projects. I think it would be really helpful to have this group look at. You know, a lot of folks here go to the transit conferences and hear about the equity strategies. The folks on this group, I don't think necessarily do. Some of us haven't been to those. And so I think really evaluating and sharing those pilots that have already been done, and more than pilots, I mean, Minnesota, what did they do around housing and on the transit line and tying in the bond? You know, how did LA get an initiative passed to provide incentives for development around transit areas? I mean, those are directly related to the work and, you know, what Seattle doing. I mean, I think actually sharing, you know, to me, you have a group of very talented people that you selected, and they understand the housing need very well. You understand it very well. And focusing on, hey, let's really call out those strategies and have them really refine and advise us on what are the ones that are going to be the most meaningful and have the most meaningful impact. And we can probably, you know, they can list them all, give us a menu, and we can prioritize and see what we have appetite for. But I think it's important for us to send a message that we want them to think creatively and big about how to solve this challenge.
I think that's really helpful, and we'll want to do that. I do want to address one other thing that Councilor Harrington brought up, which is the engagement of property owners and just engagement in general when it comes to the Southwest Equitable Development Strategy and Portland engaging their community on their Equitable Housing Grant and the Southwest Corridor Light Rail DEIS that's happening right now. So we are trying very hard to align all of those pieces when it comes to engagement. And property owners are being very, very thoroughly engaged under the light rail EIS. And we are in the process of doing all these different efforts. We're trying not to confuse people. And so we're not just like we have the one struggle group here. We didn't want to ask our community partners to be involved in more than one group. And so we worked with Portland and Tiger to create one that we use for that purpose. We're trying to do the same thing with all of the outreach and engagement so that we're more effectively engaging all of these different groups. It's a challenge, but that's what our goal is in terms of engaging our both property owners and citizens and the interested, all of the different organizations that are part of the work that's happening in Southwest Corridor. And that's why I wanted to go through all the different activities that are going on there right now, because there's a lot.
Well, I'm curious about that answer, because what I'm raising are the commercial property owners, not housing advisory group and equity. So I'm confused by your saying it's the purple group.
That was an example.
Oh, okay. Okay, I got it.
The purple group is an example of how we're aligning that.
Yeah.
We, Aaron Key has been knocking on the doors of all of the businesses and all along the light rail alignment, and knocking on doors partly because often the business that's in a building doesn't actually own the building, and so we need to be sure to reach both the owner and the business.
Property
and
owner.
So we're doing that.
Yeah.
And that is different than the group.
So I ended up having two sheets, so I forgot an item. On the diversity, equity, and engagement that you have listed, I read the paragraph on who, and I think there's really two groups that I think are missing that provide influence with regard to Washington County. And if you go back to the map that you have of the corridor, I think one thing that would help is this is an important corridor. Even though it doesn't touch my district, getting this project done and done well is still very important to the residents and businesses in my district, because we travel through and the interconnectedness for places people to work as well as to live. So I think it would be very helpful to have at least a brief bullet down here about how much of just the mileage of that proposed corridor is in Washington County versus in Multnomah County. But where this really goes is for that DEI engagement, community action and BAN, I think, are important to include in this list. this feels very Portland-centric to me. And, you know, getting both of them on board, Community Action and VAN, will benefit not only this project, but the entire Thrives effort. And we're still having to do a lot of work to build political will with the Board of Commissioners to consider that proposal. Does anyone have anything else?
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Great. So our next agenda item is Metro Attorney Communication.
Thank you, Deputy Council President. So that's the council. I'll try to put this brief because we have another next session. The big thing that has been on my plate for the last couple of weeks and years and decades, particularly the last couple of weeks in the hotel project, we are getting close to done. As I said, I think the last time all of the Metro's steps have been taken, and now we're waiting to hear the developers lining up their financing. And I've been dealing with their bank's attorneys to help them understand this complicated deal and walking them through it. We have also had ratings presentations to the two ratings, S&P as well as Moody's. We had that the other day, and that's where we go through it. It's sort of a dog and pony show describing the whole deal to the ratings agencies. They will give us a rating, which will determine what the yield on the bonds is. We're shooting for a double A minus. We will see. We are just about done with everything that has to be done except a final negotiation, which will be coming to you at some point, the amendment of the DFA, the Development and Finance Agreement. We talked about that briefly in exec session a while ago. We'll be coming to you with an update when we get the financing plan finalized from the developers. So we are having daily meetings, sometimes multiple phone conferences with 30 people on the line. The underwriters, our outside tax counsel, the underwriters' attorneys. We've got Oklahoma County to do what they need to do. There's just a lot of steps. And it's all getting there. So right now, the trick is going to be just really our developer getting their financing in place, getting their bank's attorneys to understand the deal well enough to grant them the money, and then coordinate the dance of closing. We'll sign a bond purchase agreement, which at that point we negotiated it, and it's all but final. At that point, when we sign that bond purchasing agreement, our Metro's commitment to issue the bonds goes hard. And we won't do that. We won't sign the bond purchase agreement until the developer comes to us and waives or satisfies all of their conditions to closing, at which point they go hard. And we have to dance and make sure that those two things coalesce. And that's what we're doing. So it's exciting. It's draining. But we're gonna get there. I will probably be going on my vacation starting on Saturday. All this was supposed to happen a month ago, and you know that was all going to be solid. Now it was going to then happen this Thursday, and now the developer is not ready. I'm kind of thinking it won't happen until I get back, but it might happen until while I'm gone. It's all in place. Ashley is doing a fantastic job. She just knows every detail of every document, and She's doing a fantastic job. So if it goes well, if you have to sign the bond purchase agreement while I'm gone, you will be in good hands. And I'm still going to sit on one of those stools and toast it once it gets up there. That is taking Ashley and mine a lot of our time lately. We are also downstairs. I was also this week speaking the Oregon Women Lawyers Group, OWLS, at the federal courthouse. It was the topic was women general counsels in Portland, and it was me, Multnomah County Council, who's another woman, and City of Portland County Council, City of Portland Council, who is another woman. the three of us actually meet monthly for breakfast to just kind of trade ideas. And it was really kind of fun to be talking in the courthouse with them. We had about 70 attorneys there in the audience, mostly women. OWLS is open to men, but it's Oregon Women Lawyers Association, so there's usually a couple of male attorneys, but mostly women. So that was really interesting to talk about the public sector and why that may be more attractive to women than the private sector. All three of us had worked for large law firms and left and came to the public sector. So it's a very kind of cool thing that in Portland right now, Multnomah County, City of Portland, and Metro have women general counsels. So it was a fun lunch. All of the women in my office came, the attorneys and the staff. Gary is working on the City of Gresham land use application for Ambleside. The application is for habitat and floodplain restoration and historic resource review for removal of the Schacht House. Is that what you say? Schacht. You know all that Roger's doing on the reserves, and you'll hear about that soon. We will be coming to you this summer with a change in the code. As I said, we're kind of slowly going through and getting all of the code up to state law standards. What we've recently revised is the initiatives and elections code. It was not in compliance with state law. It had gone up. State law had changed and our code hadn't been changed to reflect it. We didn't want to mess with it during the election cycle, so now we're going to change it and bring it to you, and it will be completely in line with state law. And it will also be much more clear to the general public as to how to file an initiative, and also be much more clear to us as to what the mechanisms are. When the PSU initiative was filed, that's when we discovered that there are lots of ambiguities in our code versus the state law. Joel has been drafting a model affordable housing covenant produced by the Todd program. That will be something that we record at closing that will require that the development be used for affordable housing in perpetuity.
That follows our ETOD authorization that we did at the council a while back. Cool.
Joel is also working on a model grant agreement for the equitable placemaking program. And Roger is finalizing the IGAs with cities regarding awards of the equitable housing grants under the CET program. In procurement, the other thing that's still keeping Ashley busy is she is revising. Now that we've done and you have passed the administrative laws, which are temporary, they'll be coming back to you for the permanent. They're being promulgated now and getting comments. She is revising the solicitation templates. So all of the templates that procurement uses are being updated to reflect state law. And it's a mammoth task. She's not going to be the only one. We're all kind of dividing it up so nobody gets buried, but Ashley's taking the lion's share of it. Michelle's been advising on requests for proposals related to processing commercial food waste. So that's another procurement issue on the commercial food waste front. And Shane has been working with solid waste staff to draft, this is again more procurement, the proposed transportation and disposal contracts that are going out to bid later this year. We are also helping them with solid waste staff with an RFP for transportation, the RFQ for disposal site, and the RFP for the disposal site. And that will all occur within the next 4 months. Finally, let's see. Willamette Falls, we're working on new IGA with the public partners and negotiating with the owner regarding the design. He needs to sign the applications as owner. And finally, as I always end with, Joel continues to work on reviewing records requests for the city. This time we have one from PETA, a large public records request regarding politics. And that's what I've got in addition to what we'll be hearing in the session.
Councilor Craig?
Back to the hotel bond. Why would we get the rating that you mentioned as opposed to a AAA?
Because unlike what you're familiar with our natural areas and zoo bonds, which are general obligation bonds, and therefore they're backed by Metro's full faith and credit, these bonds for the hotel are revenue bonds. they are not backed by our full faith and credit, which means that Metro's general fund is not at risk. They're backed by the transit lodging tax system. They're not only backed by one hotel's taxes, which is how we originally envisioned it, they're backed by all the hotels in Multnomah County's transit lodging tax. That's not as strong of a pledge as general.
As everything.
So we have been, for years, trying to come up with the best way to make that credit the strongest. It's a single source credit, so you know, if the reason it doesn't get to get a double A minus would be a historic event.
You say double A minus is very good.
Yes, right.
And we're not promising that. Depending on what the rates are, we will be able to come up with $60 million in proceeds, even if the rate is below that. But it relies on one industry, hotels. So if there were another 9/11, God forbid, the ratings agencies think about that, and they think, well, this won't be as strong. We've stress-tested that event and shown that the fund is solid enough to pay for the debt service, even with a worse than 9/11 tab. We've got backup pledges with our EFTA that we agreed to with the county. So we think we have a very robust pledge, but it's not as strong as full faith and credit. And we couldn't, if you may remember years ago, we were thinking of full faith and credit. We can't do that because it's a private party that's going to own the hotel, and that would violate the constitutional level of credit, opines our tax council. So that's why we amended the IGA to have a bucket that goes to bucket 4, which will be our bonds, and it's all of the taxes for the whole Multnomah County.
Okay, so we really need to move on. Are there any questions? If you've got any other questions, if you could take them offline, that'd be great. We need to come back to an item that Councillor Craddock, you requested for Andy Shaw to come back and talk about, I think it was the surcharge information. And if we could do it all in no more than 10 minutes, because we still have an executive session we need to do.
No pressure.
Thank you. I wanted just to have you review with us. I'm passing out the frame for the regional local surcharge funding decision making that Craig's been working on, and you, obviously. And I'd like to go over with this the piece about Metro. It approves or remand JPAC project committee 150% list, must concur with the determination of JPAC project committee unless Metro finds that JPAC failed to comply with criteria. So how is this different than the current role that Metro Council plays in, JPAC plays in this? What's different? This to me seems weaker than what I had thought it was, and I am concerned. It really undermines, I think, our role, and I'm just afraid it can contribute to that, you know, the camel's nose under the tent thing. And so I just have you review that with us. And then the other thing I just want to clarify, because this is surcharge dollars, so these are gas taxes. So most of this money, we can only use it on roads / right-of-way, like bike trails that are long right-of-way, that kind of thing. So we're limited. We're not able to use this money in other ways that we traditionally do have some interest. I'm just saying that out loud, just to confirm that. But so you can go back and tell us about your nervousness or your concern or...
So, just first of all, this document came out of a staff meeting. It was written up by some staff on the west side, mainly Seton Hill Borough in Washington County. It was presented to a staff group as a way to think about how to structure governance. And it did serve to educate the process, but it doesn't totally reflect, I think, where we landed. One piece of context. The second piece of context is JPAC Metro, as the MTO, are structured around the federal dollars, the federal requirements, and rules and regs that govern those dollars. The surcharge is a brand new thing, and it would be, hopefully, state-level money if we can sustain that piece of it, that would come from gas tax registration fee and, therefore, be governed by a constitutional restriction that has to be spent in the right of way. So just a couple differences from the flexible funds process that we're used to. So entering into this discussion, early on, we talked about some list pressers in working with our local partners to bring to Salem a unified regional position on how to govern this new surcharge dollars in with this new proposal. And I think as we reported to you over time, there were some pressures to make it only JPECT and not have any role for Metro, or to create a different decision-making structure. Early on, there were conversations about doing this in the ports footprint, which is mostly the area of the three counties, and then what would govern the decision-making around how the surcharges get allocated. I'll take even one more step back, which is to say that the initial discussion was just creating a surcharge to fund the share of the bottlenecks that would be required from the localities. And we evolved that discussion to include a broader, a little higher tax rate to allow for surcharge revenues to fund additional local projects of regional significance. So as that conversation evolved, we then were struggling with, okay, how exactly do we govern this? And I think in some of the meetings and with the principals and with staff, we got to a place of understanding a desire by some of the local jurisdictions to move some of the discussion a little more local initially about where projects come from than is true with the flexible fund allocation process. We tend to set some high-level targets to begin with and then bring things through to a local level. This would be a little different in this iteration. And then there was discussion about should there be a role for Metro, and if yes, then what should that role be? And it morphed over time from it should simply be an appeals process. If someone has a problem with what JPAC does, then they could appeal it, and Metro could rule on whether it was procedurally proper or not. And Craig and the staff locally pushed back and said, you know, we've got a regional decision-making process there. These projects eventually need to get added to the MTIP, need to get added to the regional transportation plan. So there should be some review of consistency with those plans and those regional decision-making processes. And I think over time we got to a place of compromise that said, let's add a bit more process on the local level to bring forward projects. City of Portland is saying, well, we hear that, but we're also 40% of the region's population, and we only have one member on this committee. So we want to talk about if we're setting some allocation targets for those local project development processes. We want to see a fair allocation process that recognizes the amount of workers and people in the city of Portland. So that discussion is ongoing. And then both city of Portland and we, you know, said we think there should be a more robust role for Metro. So then the discussion became, should we rely on the criteria in addition to procedural rules? Rely on criteria that had been written into the draft legislation that had been being prepared by staff, and that's what's on the second page, which speaks to, you know, movement of people throughout the region in both highways and pedestrian activity. And for me, the most important piece, consistency with local, regional, and state land use and transportation plans. The other three items are really the legal use of the funds. Not spending more than you're actually going to have, not overspending the amount of resources you're going to have, and that the local government where the project is going to happen actually endorses the project. I think we tried to have some pretty frank discussions about what are people worried about with Metro Council having an oversight, and on the flip side, what's our council worried about bringing forward? And the bottom line, I think, became, you know, having a couple Metro councilors who didn't like the project, rejecting it for reasons that aren't backed up by some policy or some kind of criteria. And on the flip side, you know, having, as we discussed a week ago, having projects come forward that are clearly outside of our transportation lane use goals, and how we're going to build and operate the transportation system. A West Side bypass, for example. And I think we talked about that previous meeting. The scale of these resources, A, would not really allow a construction of those kinds of facilities. Pre-planning could be something that comes along through the process. But to the extent that a West Side bypass is neither envisioned nor consistent with our existing land use policies or the RTP, that the council could say, no, that's we're going to set that back. We also had involvement in those early stages of the coordinating committees with councilors that participate in the process. I don't know if they vote in each, they're probably different in each iteration. And then we, along with everyone else, would have a representative on that subcommittee. The full JCAC would have the membership it has now, and the Metro Council would have some of these. Like the third bit of context was reminding yourselves and pointing out to the group there that nobody, there's one person who says that this happened once back in ancient history, but no one can remember a time when Metro actually rejected the work of the coordinating committees and JPAC coming all the way up to the Metro Council. There's been some confusion about the Gresham project recently, that somehow that was Metro sending it back. We tried to clarify with folks that that was JPAC failing to get to a majority vote on either of the two projects, but for some people it felt like Metro sending a project back or somehow rejecting it. But just trying to remind folks that the fear of the council using its oversight role to send a project back has never been realized because of the collaboration that we do and the fact that we do all this regional RTP planning and try to ensure that all those projects are added into that planning process. So I hope that's some helpful context for where we are now. I'd also just remind that we've been working really hard to draft this language for a bill that at the moment is not the direction the legislature is going. So we may be spinning our wheels around getting to a tough agreement about something that we actually can't convince the legislature to do.
If the surcharge itself?
Yes, if they make, well, no, if they make the surcharge localized, it would change the nature of how they would do it.
Because we would have to
do it. Don't understand quite yet. And if the whole thing falls apart, then yes.
So if you don't mind, Bob, I'm going to jump in first.
Thank you, of course.
I think overall this is pretty good. You know, it's a little bit different, and, you know, it's a change, and there can be fear about that. I just want to share a couple of anecdotal things. With the Region 1 Act, remember when it was established, there was discussion about having an active transportation rep there, it's there, and then making sure that there's representation across all of the counties, business reps, but also the opportunity for health representatives and environmental justice. And the way things stand, currently the only county that has allocated such reps continues to be just Multnomah County. So that bothers me a little bit because those types of areas and problems are present in all of our counties in our region. So I'm just on a soapbox that most of you can identify with. On the criteria part, you know, it talks about consistency with local, regional, and state land use and transportation plans. But to me, that doesn't particularly reference that projects would need to come out of a regional, an adopted regional transportation plan or a study, much like we're already dealing with projects for this major RTP update. So I hope that is more explicitly understood, that this isn't a time to take the criteria and create new projects that have gone through a public process.
And at the staff level, at least, as we've talked about it, we've been saying, we all imagine you're bringing forward projects that are on the ice with RTP. And if you're doing that, then what are you worried about in terms of the council?
So I'm not trying to wordsmith, but rather leave it up to all you certified smart people on how to work all the language through a process that continues to be very complicated and in process. So like for most of this, I'm good to go. So there was that one area, and then the other area on the criteria is on the second bullet, I don't see how the language to foster active transportation use, period, versus in lieu of auto use. Some people with a robust active transportation system don't have to actually own a car. So it's not in lieu of auto use because they don't have a car to begin with. But also what we've learned through the development, I'm preaching to the choir here, right? That regional active transportation plan, it helps people with travel options, but also for better access to transit. And so that those four words to me don't help with criteria at all.
So remember, this is in the context of creating a congestion improvement program. So this is all meant to be related to, we're creating a surcharge in order to relieve congestion. So that's the linkage from that to the car use is saying you're pulling folks off the highway.
Okay.
That's
good reminder.
Out of cars, yes.
Yeah, and I had to read the first bullet again because at first I was like, wait, we're only dealing with traffic bottlenecks and safety issues on interstate highways and state highways, and I somehow my first read I didn't see and regional arterials
yes.
in there. So okay.
And the cycling bundles and bridges, all that was very carefully crafted to make sure everyone on the table
yeah.
could see.
Yes, the connection. Yeah, I get it. I get it now. Thank you. I had to catch up a bit. Since I've been gone. Councillor Stacey.
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank Councillor Craddock for sharing this with the full council. I haven't seen this document. I've seen various, heard various descriptions of it.
And one reason I didn't share this was because it was just a staff post that went to a staff meeting and it didn't represent agreement, per se. But it helped.
Good
more on the basis of what.
And it has modified since.
Yes,
this was done.
Not accurate.
So maybe I shouldn't ask all the questions I had reading it. But, you know, 150% of what? You know, we get, let's say, $20 million in year X of this surcharge surplus of the bonding requirements for the three department projects. $20 million, so 150% would be $30 million, okay, that would be considered for allocation. Then by what measuring stick is that, did I say $30 million? That $30 million sub-allocated to four, mm-hmm. Four groups, they call them here, county coordinating committees. In fact,
first, that's the first error.
Yeah, we have two county coordinating committees. We have one city that operates as its own coordinating committee. Then we have a sub-district of Multnomah County. And Multnomah County is a wild card. I mean, sometimes the board will want to position itself with the four cities in East Multnomah County, or Central Multnomah County, but East region. With the city of Portland and those communities, sometimes they've got some bridges to get done or bridges to make progress on. I can see them behaving in a distinctly different way from the coordinating committees in Clackamas and Washington County, where there's an effort to bring everybody together around a single objective. Second, as has already been alluded to, 40% of the region's population is in the single city of Portland. 9% is in that part of Multnomah County outside of the city of Portland, inside the growth boundary. 17% is in Clackamas County. A third of the population of the region is in urban Washington County, including its cities. Do we allocate the 150% into four subparts that look sort of like those numbers? And then if that's the case, I get a little more relaxed about, not because that's perfect, but because it at least allows for some proportionality in initial proposals. I think I was concerned about the adequacy of these criteria to enable the JPAC committee, subcommittee as a whole, JPAC as a whole, and then the Metro Council and its limited review function to permit them to say, wait, yeah, every one of the projects listed is in our big, huge RTP, both the aspirational or what we now call it
strategic
component and the constraint component. But gosh, when you add those pieces up, we're doing some goofy things. And they don't reflect some urgent concerns that the JPAC as a whole or the council are aware of and want to see addressed more strongly. Should there be an allocation by state of facility readiness? How many miles of sidewalks do you not have on your roads? Character and quality of arterials in terms of their ability to move both people and vehicles, racial equity lens, safety considerations. Those would be ways of saying, you know, if we're going to be doling out this money in some way other than relating to population, how do we ensure that from a regional perspective we're ringing the right bells around the region? So
the discussion at the staff level so far has been looking at a few different ways to create allocation targets.
Yeah.
It would be for those four areas. And the discussion really ranged from using something like the registered vehicles, or population, or employment, or some combination thereof. And Stat City of Portland have run the numbers on each of those.
Yeah.
And they've proposed, unsurprisingly, a mixture of population and employment. Because when you do that, that shows where people
travel demand
and where they travel to work. And that does tend to boost Portland's number a tiny bit. We're talking about 1% up or down on all three of those measures.
So let's go next. I'm really concerned about your time.
Okay. Yeah.
And I understand how interested you all are in the topic, so I don't need to cut you off. But
I think we're close to, at the staff level, at least, a proposal that says, you know, use some combination of those three factors, probably the population employment, as a reasonable way to set a target for each of these groups, to take that their portion of that 30 million, bring up
some sort
of. So, okay, time out. So here's the problem. We do need to move on for the executive session. We don't have a work session next week, right?
I think that's correct.
Yes. So I'm really wondering, and the legislation work is happening sort of fast and furiously, and so
this,
I don't...
This piece will take a little longer. The concept is we're trying to have JPAC self-govern, so we're trying to have these decisions come through JPAC. About the subcommittee, about allocations and those questions, and then the rest of the structure would go in statute. So there's time, I think, to keep talking about this. The theory is we'll bring some form of resolution to JPAC in the June meeting or something in that time frame to try to resolve.
So Andy, we could plan some update
yes.
Thursday, the 25th.
No, I think we should come back and make sure that before you have a proposal that goes to JPAC, it needs to get in front of the council at a work session.
I think that's a reasonable request.
And
I hope we can do the same thing on the statutory work.
And
the bill will be drafted still for another week and a half, 2 weeks or so. There's still.
So please work with Nellie on the council pending calendar, because there are some holes, there are opportunities, and potential two full areas. So if you could work with her and schedule that, we can get on with the executive session. Thank you for your flexibility in coming back.
Thank you.
You can always talk to staff.
Okay, I'm going to reserve my comments. I just want to be clear that I'm not there. Yet.
Well, it's not like things have moved since then, and so that what I'm concerned about is like taking this document and this isn't even occurring.
No pressure.
So we don't have a work session next week, so you know we're going to have to figure it out.
Right.
My apologies for my overly wordy.
Oh, no problem with it. Great.
Next room over.
Where are we having the executive session?
Are we doing it?
Okay, great. Let's adjourn to our equity.